This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge, in for Frank Stacio. Hillary Clinton declared victory in the Democratic primary race for the White House yesterday.
It may be hard to see tonight, but we are all standing under a glass ceiling right now. But don't worry, we're not smashing this one. Thanks to you, we've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee for president of the United States.
But her challenger, Bernie Sanders, says he will continue his quest.
We are going to fight hard to win the primary in Washington, D.C., and then we take our fight for social, economic, racial, and environmental justice to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And Donald Trump asks for votes from Bernie supporters.
To those who voted for someone else in either party, I'll work hard to earn your support, and I will work very hard to earn that support. To all of those Bernie Sanders voters who have been left out in the cold by a rigged system of superdelegates, we welcome you with open arms.
Joining us now, as he often does, is political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Phoebe.
Ken, is there controversy over whether the declaration of Hillary as the victor is premature?
Well, not according to the Democratic rules. I mean, of course, Bernie Sanders makes the point, and it's an accurate point, that these superdelegates are not, I mean, the regular pledged delegates are bound as a result of what happened during the primaries. The superdelegates don't actually vote until the convention in July in Philadelphia, and they could theoretically change their mind. So Bernie Sanders, while at the same time decrying the influence of the superdelegates, says he's going to try to make the case that because polls show him doing better against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton, he's going to try to get these superdelegates to change their minds. So he is saying it's premature. But, you know, by all accounts, this is the way the Democratic system is. They have all these hundreds of superdelegates. An overwhelming number of them, have endorsed Hillary Clinton. And while so it's not official until late July in Philadelphia, it is clear to say, it's fair to say, that she is the presumptive nominee.
A number of primaries yesterday. What happened in California, arguably the largest?
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, we keep talking about how the polls have been off so many states, like in Michigan, which Hillary Clinton was supposed to win and Bernie Sanders won. In Oregon, where Hillary Clinton had a 15-point lead and Bernie Sanders won that. The polls in California showed it to be very close among Latinos, among young voters, among the whole electorate. And Hillary Clinton won a resounding victory, 58-42. And, of course, you know, the talk beforehand was that, wow, wouldn't it be ironic if Hillary Clinton clinched the nomination with a big victory in New Jersey, which is what happened, but then lost California. And then, of course, if she lost California, Bernie Sanders would have the argument to make the superdelegates that, look, here I am, and she's a wounded warrior. But she won big, and I think much of Bernie Sanders' argument went out with that victory in California.
Bernie Sanders says he's going to keep going, but the New York Times reported that he's laying off many of his campaign staffers. How does he keep going?
Well, he's still raising money. He's not raising money as much as he has been earlier in the year, but there are two ways of looking at it. He did say, as we heard in your tape, that he will compete in next Tuesday's primary in the District of Columbia, which is the final primary of the year. And then he said, then we're going to take our cause to Philadelphia. And so one wonders whether he will either still be fighting for the nomination, or perhaps more probably, he will still be fighting for changes in the platform. And that means reducing the influence of superdelegates, letting more independents vote in Democratic primaries, increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, working language on trade deals and fracking and things like that. So, yes, while he will stay, Bernie Sanders will stay to the end of the primaries, which is next Tuesday, which is exactly what Hillary Clinton did with Barack Obama in 2008. She stayed to the end of the primaries, and then 4 days later, she endorsed him. The question is whether Bernie Sanders will endorse Hillary Clinton 4 days after the, or 4 weeks after the primaries are over.
Is there anyone higher up in the Democratic Party talking about how Sanders continuing in this race is causing harm to the greater cause?
Well, yes, of course. They've been doing that for a long time, and most of them, of course, are Hillary Clinton supporters. But that's what they said about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008. Many Democrats said that Hillary Clinton's attacks on Barack Obama is going to hurt party unity. It'll hurt the case and the cause against John McCain in November. She should get out of the race earlier. Well, as it turned out, she waited until the end, even though it was a pretty bitter primary. But then she wholeheartedly endorsed Obama, and she campaigned with him. She was a great surrogate for him, and it was the United Democratic Party in 2008. So while the polls show a large amount of disunity on the Democratic side, an NBC poll showed that 20% of Hillary Clinton's of Bernie Sanders supporters would rather vote for Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton. Now, of course, it's one thing to say this on June 8th. It's another one to say it on November 8th. But right now, look, you know, I mean, the party has a chance of being united. Right now, there are a lot of bitter feelings.
And on the GOP side, Donald Trump continues to create controversy over the judge in the Trump University case. What is that about?
Well, this is Donald Trump being Donald Trump. Basically, this is, of course, a longstanding a fraud claim by Trump University students against Donald Trump that he misled them on many things in this Trump University thing he put together. And, of course, and as it turned out, that the judge who is hearing this case is of Mexican descent. Of course, he was born in Indiana, but his parents are from Mexico. And Donald Trump said, I will not get a fair trial because he's Mexican. And that not only upset and angered Democrats, and Hillary Clinton referred to it last night in her victory speech, but it just drives people like Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who's on Donald Trump's list of potential running mates. It drives them crazy, saying this is inexcusable, this is racist, this is crossing the line with the separation of powers. And everybody seems to be knocking him on this. And, of course, in many ways, Trump, in many instances, Trump won't back down. Last Sunday on Face the Nation on CBS, John Dickerson said, well, what if it was a Muslim judge? Would he or she be prejudiced against you? And Trump said, well, let me think about it. Yeah, absolutely. He or she would. So there's no backing down. There's a lot of controversy. And Trump's argument is, look, I didn't get here without controversy. This kind of saying what I think has gotten me where I am today, and I'm going to continue doing it.
Have we ever seen a candidate who has taken so many kind of character hits as we're seeing Donald Trump take?
No. And I've been saying this on your show for so many months. Every time we think he crosses a line or says something incendiary or insulting or inflammatory or even controversial, we say, okay, this time he's gone too far. He's mocked a disabled, he mocked a journalist because of his disabilities. This time he's gone too far. He mocked John McCain being held prisoner in North Vietnam. This time he crossed a line. But his numbers keep going up and up and up. The thing is that it's now a different audience. All this time, it's been Republicans who've been listening, and he's done very well with Republicans. There were once upon a time 16 other candidates on stage with him. They're all gone. But there's a different, jury. If you have now Latinos ready to vote, you have African Americans ready to vote, you have Democratic leaning women ready to vote. And right now, they're giving the polls indicate that Donald Trump is going to have a hard time winning them over, especially if he keeps saying these kind of controversial things.
So now with Trump completely focused on the general election, what should we expect?
It's going to be 5 months of hell. It really will. It'll be ugly. Look, the polls show that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are the only two general election candidates in memory, if not history, who have more unfavorable numbers than favorable numbers, and we've never had that. So the question is who we dislike the least, who we vote for, or who we're going to vote against. It won't be pretty. If you listen to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump last night, they're ready to go at each other, and the question is, which party unites the fastest? Right now, the Bernie Sanders campaign and supporters are not ready to go along with Hillary Clinton, but But and same with a lot of holdouts on the Republican side. But as Paul Ryan said the other day, that as much as I despise what Donald Trump said regarding the Latino judge, our goal is to beat Hillary Clinton. And, of course, the Democrats' goal is to beat Donald Trump. So there'll be a lot of holding noses and voting in November.
8 months ago, did you ever expect that this is the way it would be shaping up, that we'd have Trump versus Clinton?
No. I mean, well, the joke at the time was that we talked about, you know, these people who were anointed, and Hillary Clinton was going to be the anointed Democrat, but the anointed Republican was supposed to be Jeb Bush. He had the famous name, the famous Rolodex. He had $100 million in the bank. But you know something, in fairness to Donald Trump, he showed that all these candidates had major, major weaknesses. Jeb Bush couldn't get a coherent paragraph, let alone a sentence, out of his mouth about where he wanted to bring the country. Whatever you think about Donald Trump, he talked about change that so many voters, including so many Republicans, desperately are crying out for. Not only are Republicans upset about the last 7 years under Obama or fearful of what Hillary Clinton will bring, but they're upset about their own Republican leadership in Congress. Mitch McConnell and once upon a time John Boehner. I mean, we voted Republican so we can get rid of Obamacare. Why do we still have Obamacare? These are the kind of, well, why do we have beheadings by ISIS overseas? Why do we have attacks in San Bernardino, California by homegrown terrorists?
Well,
these are the kind of, I'm sorry?
We're going to keep thinking about that. Thanks very much, Ken.
Thanks, Phoebe. The list goes on and on.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie. This is The State of Things. We're talking today about election results. Just ahead, more on the North Carolina primary results. Stay with us. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. North Carolina voters cast their ballots in the state's second primary of the year yesterday. Turnout was low for the congressional races and one seat on the state's highest court. Two incumbent members of the House faced off in the Republican primary for the 2nd District. George Holding won over Renee Elmers, a one-time Tea Party favorite. Joining me now to talk about the results is WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Phoebe.
Also with me from the legislature is WUNC Capitol reporter Jorge Valencia. Hi, Jorge.
Hey, Phoebe.
So, Jeff, first tell us about this turnout, this low turnout.
Yeah, very low. About 500,000 folks turned out to vote yesterday. There are, you know, more than 6.5 million registered voters across the state of North Carolina. This works out to less than 8%. Now, this is lower than primaries in presidential years. This, of course, as you mentioned, the second primary for North Carolina in this presidential year, because a panel of three federal judges ruled earlier this year that two of the state's congressional districts were illegal racial gerrymanders. So that sent state lawmakers into a special session. They redrew the congressional maps, and it was not possible to take care of this congressional primary on March 15th, thus the June 7th primary that we had yesterday. So this second primary sent even fewer people to cast ballots, and it was not a strong show of voter turnout or Democratic involvement, if you will.
And Jeff, let's look at the second congressional district, mm-hmm. which is kind of getting the most news. It was an unusual race on the Republican side because it featured two incumbents.
Right.
You mentioned, how did this happen?
So these redrawn districts, George Holding is the sitting congressman presently in the 13th district, and Renee Elmers is the congresswoman from the second. So when they redrew this thing, the second district shifted north and east, and it looked more like Holding's district than it does presently Elmer's district. So the new second, Elmer still lives in it, Holding doesn't. So he opted to run for the new congressional second as opposed to the new 13th, which is a totally different geographic boundary that stretches from Burlington to Boone. So Holding opted in. You don't have to live in the boundary that you're running for to be a congressperson. You have to live in the state. So Holding ran in this district that leans right, and I talked with a strategist last week, one of his strategists, who said Holding was up by 30 points. And I thought, all right, probably not up by 30 points. And indeed he was. As soon as the initial results came in last night, he was comfortably up by 28 to 32 points the whole night as results flowed in. And Holding, I mean, he really had a hold on this race. It was not close. He really harped on Elmer's not being as conservative as she had claimed to be, not being a reliable conservative. So he will get almost certainly a third term in the U.S. House. So, it's the only race in the the country where there were two incumbents facing off, that it's rare for an incumbent to lose. And of course, it's even more obscure for incumbents to be battling against one another.
I wonder if anyone in the Elmer's camp was saying, hey, stay out of our territory. I mean, I can imagine this made people kind of angry.
I don't know if the one of the her gripes with him in terms of the territory, which is an interesting point you bring up, largely centered on, hey, this congressman, this George Holding guy, he's not even here in the state. He doesn't know this district. He doesn't know the farmers. He doesn't know, you know, have a good sense of the counties that are that are represented by the second. Obviously, that rhetoric did not play well yesterday.
And Holding led in terms of money also.
He did. He led in money big time. As you mentioned, Renee Elmers was swept in 2010, largely because of Tea Party money, because of Americans for Prosperity and Koch brothers backed advertisements. And it was Holding who, having a more now they're both firmly conservative, but Holding with a stronger conservative record is the one who got the Tea Party money this time. And that helped in ousting her. I mean, a lot more money, outside money, advertising money came in for him. And that was the story here.
Did Donald Trump play any role in either of these?
You know, it's interesting. Elmers was, I believe, the fifth member of Congress to support him, the first woman, back on March 15th. She came out and said, I voted for Donald Trump. He, over the weekend, you know, logged his support, his endorsement for her, recorded a robocall, tried to get involved. Political experts say it was a little too late for him to really have an influence on this. So.
Let's turn to the 13th district, where 22 contenders battled it out. Jorge, give us a sample of who ran.
Yeah, and there's a direct connection between that George Holding and Renee Elmers race in the 13th district, because George Holding is right now is the incumbent in the 13th district. So now that there is no incumbent running for the 13th district, it created a vacuum. And so a lot of people threw in their hat, mostly Republicans, because the district is designed to favor Republicans. So we had 17 people who said, I can win the Republican nomination. And we had a sample of people who'd been in elected office locally, people who elected and been in elected office at the state level. And we had some political outsiders who had never held or even ran for political office.
And one of those political outsiders won the GOP nomination. Who was he?
Yes, his name is Ted Budd. He is from Davie County. He owns a firearms complex there. He's also a farm owner. And he was supported by an outside group. Well, first of all, let's just out of the gate say that he came out pretty far ahead. He came out with 20% of the vote. The second candidates, second, third, and fourth place, they came out with about 10% of the vote. So he very handedly won this race. He also got support from a Washington-based group called Club for Growth, which injected about $500,000 worth of spending into that race, running ads, trying to run him, and really wearing this outsider thing as a badge of honor, saying this guy's a farm owner, he is a homeschooler, and he has never run for elected office. So that is the person that the voters there elected,
and a business owner also, which is what we're hearing a lot in terms of the presidential race, that there's a know-how here.
Yeah, and this connects with themes that we started seeing in 2010 when the Tea Party swept in. And now, of course, with the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party president, who says, I have business credentials, I don't have political experience, but I have business credentials, which are more important. So that theme at least seems to have resonated with voters in this district. In fact, I visited this district last week, and there were people who were telling me, I haven't decided who to vote for, but I do want somebody who's not going to just go out there and do politics, and I want somebody who's not going to go there and make a career out of it. So that tells you a little bit about the sentiment of the people who are turning out.
Jorge, Alma Adams won the Democratic race in the 12th. Was that a hard-fought race?
Well, if you look at the results, you would think that it wasn't, because she won with 40% of the vote, pretty far ahead of the second person who came in with 28% of the vote, as a former state senator, Malcolm Graham. But there was a lot of drama because, as Jeff explained, these were newly drawn districts, and the 12th district was significantly different than it was before. It encompasses mostly an area that just focuses in Charlotte and the immediate surrounding areas. The thing is that Alma Adams, she was the incumbent, so in a sense she would have been the favorite easily, but she lived in Greensboro because Greensboro was a part of this district originally. So what she did is she decided she was going to run for re-election, and she said she was going to move to Charlotte. Now, a lot of her opponents challenged her on that and criticized her, and even there was even this very interesting piece of tape that we had from a TV reporter in Charlotte who drove up to Guilford County, waited for her at her house, and just and basically she was pulling into her driveway, chased her away from her house, saying, "I thought you lived in Charlotte. Why are you coming here?" But ultimately, she did come out ahead, and she won pretty handily. Had there been a runoff for this race, she wouldn't have needed a runoff because she got more than 40% of the vote.
And just going down the line, Jeff, in the race in the ninth on the GOP side, it was incredibly tight. What happened?
Very close. Incumbent Robert Pittenger presently has 9,268 votes, and Mark Harris has 9,126 for our listeners who are driving and don't want to do that on the fly. That's a difference of just 142 votes. This is a 0.5% separation. Now, Harris, who is the runner-up, can ask for a recount. There's not, according to North Carolina election law, there's not an automatic trigger. It's not like that will automatically happen. He has to ask for it, and it's close enough that conventional wisdom is he will. Pittenger, who's ahead, is the incumbent, and this is a district that kind of wraps around Charlotte and goes almost like an L, like a weirdly shaped L. I believe it encompasses, goes up to Statesville, down through Mecklenburg County and over to Fayetteville, if I've got that right in my head, and I might be drunk over maps. But Pittenger is the incumbent, and he has come under fire over the last year. He was investigated by the FBI for alleged or possible improper donations to his own election campaigns. You know, was he violating IRS regulations? Was he violating campaign finance laws? So on and so forth. So Pittenger is very close here. I mean, this was, you know, moderately exciting thing to follow last night as the elections bounced back and forth. We should note that so 142 votes separate these two at this point. If Harris asks, there will be a recount. There are also provisional ballots floating around. Exactly how many, it is unclear at this point. The State Board of Elections has not responded to a couple of phone calls that I've put in. There are also servicemen and women from overseas who can vote until next Tuesday. And if somebody had a ballot that, a hand-printed ballot, whether it's somebody in a nursing home or a hospital or a second, for whatever reason, people who have received ballots, if they're postmarked by yesterday, those will count as well. So there's a possibility that this thing will get closer. Pittenger, the incumbent, the Republican incumbent in this ninth district, has said, based on the modern ways of counting votes, it's pretty unlikely that this is going to be that this is going to turn. But you never know.
But we won't know for a while, no matter what.
No, it won't be that long. I chatted with one Board of Elections director this morning, and he told me that barring something strange and unforeseen, next week, next Tuesday, is the last day for those overseas ballots to come in, and County Board of Elections should certify the results by the end of the day on Tuesday the 14th, so not too long.
Several current members of the North Carolina General Assembly lost their bids for higher office yesterday. Who were they, and can we read anything from those losses about how voters are responding to some rather controversial General Assembly actions as of late?
Well, Jeff, if you don't mind,
I'd like
to take this one first, because in the 13th district that we were talking about just a second ago, out of those 17 candidates, we had four members of the North Carolina General Assembly, a member of the Senate, three members of the House. They'd all been serving here for a long time. Now, typically in a race like this one, name recognition helps you a lot. And if you've been running for the General Assembly in this district for 10 years, your name has been on signs for 10 years. And people, a lot of times in a race like this one, when they have little information, they will just vote for the name that they recognize the most. So looking at it that way, you would think, okay, the General Assembly members should have won. But the reality is that the turnout was very low, and it was very easy to influence opinion making. And Ted Budd, with 500,000 supporting him, came out ahead. So in a way, I mean, you could say maybe people aren't satisfied with the General Assembly, or you could just say people just don't have that much information. It's difficult to tell.
It is. Low voter turnout. I would add that in the 12th, where Alma Adams won by more than 40% of the vote, as Jorge mentioned, and will retain.
Who herself is a former member of the General Assembly.
Right. And I think that's the Trump, no pun intended, card there, right? So she beats Malcolm Graham, who's a former state legislator, and Tricia Cotham and Rodney Moore, who are both sitting members of the House. And she did it in pretty convincing fashion. So I don't think there's too much to read into that at this point in terms of discord or discontent with state lawmakers.
Yeah. And a lot you have to consider has to be taken into account of the voter turnout. In the 13th district, Ted Budd won with 6,300 votes. That's how many people. It's very few people elected who will probably be the new congressman representing that area.
Jeff, in the race for the Supreme Court, this was an election because of an earlier legal decision, kind of complicated. Will you tell us about that situation?
Right. Simply put, Republicans did not want this election to happen. They passed a state law last year that would have created retention elections. So the incumbent here on the 7-member high court of the state is Bob Edmonds. And what state lawmakers wanted to do was create an election that would say thumbs up or thumbs down on Justice Edmonds. And if the voters said no, then okay, Edmonds would be off the state Supreme Court. But the power to seat the next justice would then go to the governor. And the governor would appoint a justice to the state Supreme Court, thus removing the democratic process of electing the 7th justice. And we should note that this justice is very important because in recent years he has held the swing vote. So it went through the courts, and the lower courts ruled that this was unconstitutional. It actually, ironically, coincidentally, made it up to the state Supreme Court. Edmonds recused himself from being involved in a decision that would have affected how he would have run moving forward. So needless to say, we got an election. We got an election of four candidates, and the Governor McCrory is not involved in this. So there were four. The top two will move on. Edmonds, the incumbent, carried about 48% of the vote. So he moves on to November. He's a conservative, and he'll face off with Mike Morgan, who is a Wake County Superior Court judge. He's an African-American, and he's a registered Democrat. So this is a race that will swing potentially on some issues the state Supreme Court. It's a very important race, and it is a race that is going to see a lot of money come in and try to influence voters over the next 5 months.
A statewide race, is there any thought about who will prevail?
Depends on whom you ask, right? And depends on what the down ballot effect of Mr. Trump. And we've heard so much about, you know, this is very concerning to Republicans, and Donald Trump is going to affect races for lieutenant governor and state senate and maybe the Supreme Court. But as we've seen on a national level, that fear has not played out yet. Donald Trump's candidacy has not yet significantly hurt down ballot incumbents, down ballot candidates or challengers. So this is going to be a tight one, and it'll be interesting to see how Trump and Clinton and national folks play into this.
Jorge, let's change gears a little bit. The State House is expected to act today on the coal ash bill. What is this bill?
Okay, so this is a bill that that the General Assembly passed very recently, and they sent it to the governor, and it was a response to a lawsuit that the governor had filed and had won recently. The governor had said that the General Assembly had too much authority over a commission that oversees the cleanup of the more than 30 coal ash ponds, toxic coal ash ponds that we have across North Carolina. Now, the Supreme Court said the governor is right, the General Assembly has too much authority over this. So the General Assembly drew a new bill in which they gave the governor a majority of the appointments to this commission, but they said we have to confirm them. And so they sent it to the governor, and the governor was none too pleased. He vetoed it. And very expectedly, we're going to have the House is expected to first take it up today. They approved this bill with an overwhelming majority. They have more than enough support to override his veto. That would have to be the first action to take. Then the Senate would have to take it up. They have even more. Almost everybody in the chamber voted for it. And then when the governor gets it, he has already promised that he is going to sue the General Assembly again, meaning that the end result will be that the process of cleaning up these ponds that Duke Energy owns across the state, that people are concerned that they may contaminate groundwater, the process is probably going to take longer.
And is it surprising that the governor is coming out on this so harshly? I mean, is this expected?
Well, I think that one of the theories that a lot of people have is that he really wants to be seen as taking a really strong stance, as one somebody who does have authority, because historically we have a lot of tension between the Senate leadership and the governor's office, regardless of who's in office. So he wants to assert his authority right now. The other thing is that he's running for re-election, and he worked for Duke Energy, which owns these ponds, for almost 30 years. So he doesn't want to be seen like he's lenient on Duke Energy. So no, perhaps it's not that surprising.
Right. To Horace's point, this gives him a little bit of cover and allows the governor moving forward to say, hey, I was tough on Duke Energy, because that's a line, that's a murky line that folks have criticized him for over the last couple of years.
Jeff Tiberi is WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
And WUNC Capitol Reporter Jorge Valencia. Thanks, Jorge.
Thanks, Phoebe.
Just ahead, we'll talk with a Greensboro author about her latest novel featuring the rise and fall of bowling.